at 1:34, and today we have many items on the agenda, and right at the start, I want to beg your indulgence and ask that you limit your testimony to no more than two and a half minutes, because we have four bills that we want to take up today and get out of here. So we do have people online to testify as well. So today we'll be hearing bills previously heard, Senate Bill 146, Snow Classic, and it has a further referral to Finance, and it's our intention to move the bill from committee. We have Senate Bill 175, Practice of Naturopathy, and it has no further referral, and we'll continue to take testimony. We may move it over, but if we do complete testimony, we may move it today, but it's our intention to take one more meeting next Thursday. Senate Labor and Commerce will not be meeting next Tuesday because we have joint meeting between Finance Committee and Resources regarding oil. Then bills that we will hear today, Senate Bill 125, Motor Vehicle Transactions, that has no further referral. Senator Meyer, here in the audience, and we will take public testimony and hold the bill. Senate Bill 149, Tax Credits for Donations to Dog Mushing, has a further referral to Finance, sponsored by Senator Thomas, and we will take public testimony on that piece of legislation. So to start, Senate Bill 146. Oh, I'm sorry. Just trying to get it done. Joining me today, Senator Menard, Senator Giesel, Senator Davis, co-chair Senator Pasquin, myself, Chair Senator Egan, and we do have a quorum. In fact, all of us are here. Now, Senate Bill 146, and again, it has a further referral to Finance. And we have previously taken testimony. Do I hear a motion?
Hold on, this is 146?
146.
Make sure I got the right.
Senator Giesel, did you have any final comments on your bill? Great. Thank
you. Mr. Chair, hold on. I'm trying. There we go. I couldn't find it. Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill number 146 from this committee to the next committee, a referral. It's identified as version /A. With individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Pasquin. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Thank you, Senator Giesel. That was quick. And the motion carries unanimously. And we'll take a brief at ease. Committee has now reconvened at 139. And next bill on the agenda is Senate Bill 175, Practice of Naturopathy, and we're continuing to take public testimony. Again, if I can ask people that are testifying to be short, and if you're just repeating something that was said previously, if you can just let folks know that you support the previous presenter's testimony. First off,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When did you want me to offer the amendment? After testimony?
You can do it right
now. You can do it right now. Okay.
How about if I do that?
Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of Amendment Number 1, version / M.4, to SB 175, version M. The amendment would replace Section 2 of the bill.
Great. Thank you, Senator Diesel. Second.
I guess just I would object just for purposes of discussion. And then we.
Yes. Great. Okay, we do have folks signed up to testify on OffNet and LIO. First, from the Fairbanks LIO, Scott Looper, Fairbanks, Alaska Association of Naturopathy. And he's available if testimony from Mr. Looper is needed. Also, Andy Harrington from Fairbanks Department of Law is available for questions from the Fairbanks LIO if needed. And we do have, from the Anchorage LIO, two folks that would like to testify, Mary Miner and must be Alaska Association of Naturopaths. Am I close? and Ms. Miner, welcome to our teleconference, and thanks for taking the time to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Miner. I'm a naturopathic doctor practicing in Fairbanks. I graduated from naturopathic school in Seattle in 1983, and on February 14th, Valentine's Day, will make my 28th anniversary of when I first became licensed as a naturopathic doctor in Washington State. I have practiced in Washington State, in Connecticut, and since 1990, I have practiced in the great state of Alaska. I am here in support of Senate Bill 175 as amended, and I certainly have made trips to Juneau before, and I have spoken before to the Labor and Commerce Committee in the Senate previously on previous attempts to expand our scope of practice, but I am here today not to expand our scope of practice, but to enshrine what we already have and not lose my ability to treat my patients as I have been well trained and as I would appreciate the ability to do in the future. I've never come to this committee with a sense of urgency that I feel today, and it is crucial to me to be able to continue to deliver services to my patients, not just because I have a lot of background and am well trained, but if my patients can't get these services from me, they're just not available to them. It is important to recognize that this is not a turf issue. When I have to face my patients and tell them that the treatments that they have received from me before and that have worked well for them are not available to them today because I do not have access to those treatments, it's not like I can tell them to go and see their other provider, their more conventional provider, because their other provider has no clue as to what these treatments are and how they work and what their contraindications are or what the contraindications are. And so it's not available to them at all, which is not in the best interest of my patients. And I feel a moral obligation to speak to the legislators and see what we can do to get our practice back to what it was a year ago. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Miner. Questions? Doctor? Seeing none, thank you for testifying. Next is Madeline Morrison, also from the Alaska Association of Naturopathy. Ms. Morrison, please.
Hi, my name is Madeline Morrison. I'm a naturopathic doctor in Anchorage. I've been in practice in Alaska since 1996 and received my license, I believe, in 1995. I agree with the testimony of Mary Miner, to make it short. I also would only add that on a regular basis, I work with medical doctors in the best interest of my patients, and we work together for a better outcome. And I just want to add that because the things that I do provide, as Dr. Miner said, aren't available in their knowledge base to provide that better outcome for our patients. So I just wanted to add that. So I agree. Please move SB 175 through this committee. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Morrison, and thank you for your brevity. Next to testify online from the Department of Health and Social Services, now back in Anchorage, Dr. Ward Herbert, and you're testifying from OffNet. Mr. Rector, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ward Herbert, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Health and Social Services. The administration does have concerns about the bill, and I want to address that. As we read the bill, we believe that it would either potentially or in reality expand the scope of practice. And my understanding in meeting with the staff of the sponsor in both the Senate and the House, and with Dr. Jackson, who testified at the earlier meeting there, is that's not the intent, as was just said, to expand practice. But we felt that the wording would do that. Dr. Jackson mentioned that he has run into a problem with capsicum. The example that he gave and showed the slides with it requiring a prescription. Our chief pharmacist did some research on that and talked with the company that manufactures that. There had been several manufacturers in the past that had not been required to have a prescription, but Gavipot, which has since become Big Ron's, the name of the company, he talked to them, and it was the company that made the decision and checked the box that the prescription be required, not something that the FDA did. And I'm not sure how widely that's known. It was certainly news to me, but that's a problem. The state has in the past considered that naturopathic doctors have not had prescribing authority, and believe that the bill would extend that, and that would incur a cost. As Dr. Jackson responded yesterday in the House Labor and Commerce Committee, and as he told me, his understanding is that authorizing prescriptions for substances derived from plants, trees, roots, moss, or fungus would indeed include substances like penicillin. When you look at the drugs that are used by allopathic and osteopathic physicians, between 25 and 50% are originally derived from natural substances, and current research goes on. I think one of the issues that may lead to some confusion is we're all trained in our own disciplines, and we get a language of our own discipline. For example, if Senator Pastan started talking legalese, he would leave me behind in about 3 seconds because that's not my vocabulary. Dr. Jackson commented that in his understanding and his training, drugs and medicines are different, that the drugs are synthetic chemical substances, whereas the medicines, being a broader term, includes the natural substances. In my understanding, my training, those terms were interchangeable, and I did look up the definition in Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, and basically the definition's there, so I think much of the public would have a similar one. I know the time's limited, so I won't come to my other points, but be available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Herbert. Questions from Senator Menard.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's probably the only question I was going to ask that I didn't ask. Isn't there a percentage of time where the natural vitamins or what we derive from herbs really is put into a prescription-type drug, too, and he answered that and clarified that. So they are interchangeable at a small percentage, like 11% of them. Is that what I'm understanding? Did I hear that correct? Because that at one point I was going to raise that question and didn't.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Bernard, clearly the what we're talking about are not vitamins and those kinds of things, but examples of other kinds of pharmaceuticals that are derived from plants would be digitalis, which used for heart failure. Most of them are more synthetic compounds now, but that's still there. Quinine, originally an anti-malarial drug, anti-cancer drugs like Vincrest and Vinblastine, penicillin, and a number of other antibiotics. So I was referring specifically to more of what would be considered the pharmacologic agents rather than vitamins or the kinds of things you might get in a health food store.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Quick questions for Dr. Hurlburt. I see Senator Giesel.
Hello, Dr. Hurlburt. It's Kathy Giesel. I had a question for you. The original definition, and this is currently in regulation for naturopaths, says herbal remedies includes medicines derived, etc. The amended form of the bill states that herbal remedy means a substance, the effort there being to separate from an herbal preparation. I think you mentioned digitalis versus foxglove. And so I guess my question to you is, you don't feel that's clear enough, that it's not a prescription pharmaceutical agent?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, my initial take on the amended language in the amendment that you submitted there, to be honest, was I think the same as yours. It looked like this would clarify it. But our pharmacist, and I would need to defer to him, felt that the language in the amendment still was broad enough that it could lead to some confusion, and saying that they are derived from natural substances still open the ability to prescribe things like in the antibiotics, like the digitalis or the anti-cancer drugs.
So, follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Hurlburt, would a more clear statement actually have a semicolon there and another phrase that says these substances do not include pharmaceutical agents?
Through the chair, from my standpoint, I think that would bring a lot of clarity to it, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Dr. Hurlburt.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Further questions for the doctor? Seeing none, next to tech, and thank you very much, Dr. Hurlburt, for coming online this afternoon. Those are the only people we have online or off-net to testify this afternoon. Now coming into the committee room, we have Mary DeSmet representing herself. And Ms. DeSmet, well, you're more than welcome to come forward if you can state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Senator Egan. My name is Mary DeSmet, for the record. Third time's a charm. I've spent 3 days on the Hill. Thank you for finally letting me speak. I am a consumer, a patient of naturopathic care in concert with allopathic care. I'm going to make this really short because I know you need to move this on. My life has been profoundly affected in a positive way by my ability to choose when is it time to go for naturopathic care, when is it time to see a Western medicine physician. I could be a poster child. I was well on my way to type 2 diabetes, and I'm here to tell you all of my labs are excellent. I am off every medication, including an antidepressant. This is very powerful, and I know I speak for many people who can't afford to be here. Please pass this through and don't take our right away to choose how we take care of our bodies. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Questions for Mr. Smith? Thank you very much for taking the time to come up here and testify. We have on, well, we have two folks available to answer questions. Don Habiger, Division of Corporate Business and Professional Licensing, is available for questions. We also have John Sheward from the Department of Health and Social Services. He's available for questions as well. And we also have Dr. Jasper again. Would you like to testify since you presented Tuesday?
I certainly won't take much of your time. I am the Dr. Jackson that Dr. Hurlburt referred to. And we spell it J-A-S-P-E-R. And I am in favor of SB 175, and we support the amendments. I just wanted to mention I enjoyed meeting with Dr. Hurlburt and the concerns about the anti-cancer drugs that may come from an herb or digitalis and whatnot is kind of forgets an important issue, and that is that every healthcare provider is limited by their training and education. That's what really defines their practice. And even though this definition in the regulations might have allowed the use of those anti-cancer drugs for the last 18 years, the fact of the matter is nobody used them for the last 18 years because that's not what our training is. And I think that that's what the safety factor is. Digitalis is always mentioned because it's a famous herbal medicine. But nobody to speak of uses digitalis anymore, nor do we. So those anti-cancer drugs and digitalis, penicillin was brought up. And again, I answered that question yesterday that yes, the definition would allow it. But I spoke to many of my colleagues on the phone in the last 24 hours. None of us know any naturopath that's been using penicillin in the last 18 years, just that the definition would allow it. But again, we practice what we're trained to do. And so these issues of the anti-cancer drugs and digitalis, I don't think are an issue because they're just not part of our practice based on our training. And I don't have anything further.
Great. Thanks, Doctor. Questions?
Yes, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Passman.
Doctor, what I would like to have a little bit more information on is what notice did you receive of any change in practice from the department or division?
Well, we didn't receive any, and I met with Mr. Habiger this morning, and it was a very nice meeting, and he was very forthcoming, and I mean, he's here, he can speak for himself, but he said that he was not aware of that he had put out any notice to that effect, and so he wondered why this change did happen, and he's been checking himself to see if somebody sent a letter or something, and he was not able to discover that. So it was interesting to meet with him because he seems to be at as big a loss as I am as to why now all of a sudden the pharmacies are getting this word and are changing their interpretation of the regulations. And that change does seem to be more in line with what Mr. Habiger proposes. But I was convinced based on my meeting to him that he is at a loss, as are we, to explain why the pharmacies have received this instruction or who they've received it from.
Senator Pascal.
And I guess following up on that, how long has the practice of naturopathic doctors having access to pharmacies for naturopathic medicines, and I use that term loosely, but how long has that practice been in place?
Well, for the last 18 years, when we passed the regulations, we showed the regulations to pharmacists, and they began honoring that for very few things, because there's not a lot of prescription drugs, but there are some.
It's been for 18 years consistent with the statutes and administrative codes of Alaska.
Through the chair, and I apologize for that, but yes, through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Further questions, Dr. Jasper, Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Jasper, just a question. If I were to offer another amendment to definition number or item number 2 in section 2, where it says herbal remedy means a substance derived from blah blah blah, semicolon, a substance does not mean pharmaceutical agent or drug. I mean, would you find that acceptable to further clarify this?
Well, through the chair, it's a big world, and we all have different opinions, and But to me, I think that would greatly confuse it, because it would just take this mix of definitions and it would throw another word in there that is also not defined, and so now we'd have the interplay of yet another word that's not defined. And so the genius of this bill, which I'm wondering what it, but we thought that, that because we defined it, if it came from a plant, a tree, a root, a moss, then it's in. You know, that's what we thought 18 years ago when we agreed to it. But to throw in another thing, and even as was mentioned earlier in Dr. Hurlburt's testimony, that the capsicum tincture, the decision to put the legend on there was the decision of the manufacturer. But that's the case with many, many prescription drugs. If the manufacturer wants to market it over the counter for self-limiting conditions, they can do so. But if they want to market it for a medical product to treat human illnesses, diseases, and conditions, it be they're required to put the legend on it. So that's not unusual, what he mentioned. And it's a, and like with niaspan, one of the 50 top prescribed drugs, we can send our patients to the health food store and they can buy time-release niacin over the counter. But if they want to get the pharmaceutical version of it, which is the same one, but it's now is a prescription drug. So adding not including pharmaceutical preparations, I think would muddy the water further. I don't know what it would add.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. Further questions for the doctor? And thank you very much on behalf of the committee for sticking around for an extra day.
I'm staying here.
Thank you. Next to testify, Mary, well, I can't read your writing.
Okay.
Sorry.
One time I had a New Year's resolution to write legibly, and I guess I didn't follow through on it.
Your writing is better than mine, actually, but I can't read mine either. Thank you.
My name is,
welcome. I apologize.
My name is Mary Alice McKean. I've lived in Alaska since 1978. I'm testifying representing myself. I'm a consumer of naturopathic care. I'm also an attorney, and I work for the federal government as an administrative judge, although I'm not here in that capacity. I support SB 175. I really appreciate all your efforts to solve this problem, because it is a problem. People want to have access to naturopathic care, and the legislature in 1986 made a policy decision that people in Alaska should have access to this type of care. And to so severely restrict the scope of practice really undermines the basic legislative decision that was made in 1986. The division's testimony at the first time that you heard this bill quoted a letter saying that patients could use substances in their natural form. And so naturopaths can recommend that patients grind up their own red pepper, but they can't write a prescription to obtain a capsicum tincture. I mean, this is not what the legislature intended. And in my opinion, the regulation really answers that squarely, because it says in 12 AAC 42990 subsection 8, the one we've heard, that a prescription drug does not include a device or herbal or homeopathic remedy or dietetic substance in a form that is not a controlled substance. Now, it doesn't say it has to be in its natural form. It really answers the form question. It says that a prescription drug cannot be in a form that is not a controlled substance. And it doesn't say it has to be in its natural form. And so I think you are just correcting misinterpretation of the legislative policy that the division seems to have recently adopted. I think, maybe that's really all I really want to say. I did pick up on Senator Pascavan's comment that there really was no notice and comment of this new interpretation, wherever it came from. Now, the regulations that we've all been listening to, they went through notice and comment procedure. The public got a chance to weigh in on it. And I assure you, if there was a proposed regulation that said prescription drug means everything you need a prescription to get, people would come out and testify and say, no, that wasn't our interpretation. We think you should be able to get B12 in its prescription form. We think you should be able to get niacin in its prescription form, red pepper in its prescription form. So there really has been no notice and comment of this new interpretation, and that's really what you're having to correct. You're kind of getting notice and comment on the new interpretation. And so I thank you for being willing to go into the reeds, so to speak, and really wrestle with this problem, because at the end of the day, this interpretation will severely restrict the practice of naturopathy in a way that, in my opinion, is really inconsistent with what you all decided, your predecessors, in 1986. So thank you again.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Pekin, and we appreciate your testimony, and thank you for taking the time to testify. Questions? Seeing none, thank you. Martin Mimi. Mr. Mimi, come forward then.
Okay.
And your name for the record, please, when you sit down.
Through the chair, I'm Martin Mimi. I'm a patient of a naturopathic doctor. She's my primary care physician. I'm 69 years old, and I'm old enough to make choices about which doctors I choose to go to first. Now, the way I interpret my choices is this. My naturopathic doctor is to guide me toward a better lifestyle, a healthier lifestyle. When it gets to the point where I have to take drugs, where I have to be surgically cut, I'll do that. I have nothing against MDs, but I look at it as a hierarchy. And I was a PE teacher and a health teacher in my training before I retired. And I think I know a little bit about health care, and I have had a wonderful experience with naturopathic doctors.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Nemi. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and testify. And again, we have two folks from departments of the state that are here to answer questions if anyone has any. Mr. Habiger, if you can come forward again, please. You know the drill.
For the record, my name is Don Habiger, and I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Senator Baskin.
You know, in the last meeting, you know, I was trying to focus upon where this all came from, and are you in agreement as far as that the naturopaths did not have any notice of this change?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, in the earlier discussion I had today with Dr. Jasper, when I heard that, I did go out to my staff and said, has anybody released any kind of formal information to pharmacists, naturopaths? And thus far, I have the answer is no. I have not found anything that the division has done, but I'm still looking.
That brings up the question, if I may, is that if no one has sent out any notice, it seems to infer that there's been no process that's been followed, so that when you advance the position you advanced in the last meeting, there's no foundation for that position. In other words, that's the outward appearance of it.
Through the chair, Senator Pasban, I did refer in the last meeting to a recent licensure action, and I also referred to what appears to me, based on history for the division, a consistent no prescriptive authority position. As required by the chair, I guess I brought my lawyer with me. That is Mr. Harrington, and he can answer those questions, I think, perhaps better than I can. But I still maintain that we have held a consistent position.
Senator Baskin.
Do you agree that from wherever the source came, that there's been a material restriction in the naturopath's ability to access pharmacies as part of their practice from what has occurred over the last 18 years?
Through the chair, Senator Pasban, I agree that the issue is before us all. I agree that they say it has. I personally don't have any evidence of that myself.
Senator Pasquin.
You know, I come back to, you know, from my legal training, everything that I'm hearing says that we have statutes that go back to 1986. We have administrative regulations that at least go back to 1994. It appears that we have solid practices that have been in existence for at least 18 years. No notice was given to the naturopaths. Certainly that implies there's no opportunity for them to be heard as a consequence of not having any notice, and therefore something has occurred, and it appears to be arbitrary and capricious to me as far as whatever the source of that might be. And so I'm laying it on the line. I'm pretty troubled right at the moment.
Mr. Habiger, and again, you did point out we have Andy Harrington from the Department of Law. Mr. Harrington, can you weigh in on this discussion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can certainly try. I think that the answer to the question is, you know, what has come up recently? The short answer is that there was a complaint filed about a naturopath for using or administering prescription drugs, and filed relatively recent in 2008, I think. In the investigation part of this, the division asked the naturopath where and how the prescription drugs were being obtained. The naturopath indicated an unwillingness to provide that information, and the division served several local pharmacies with an administrative subpoena regarding any prescriptions that may have filled for the naturopath. And I think the division investigator gave a heads up to the pharmacy board as to why these subpoenas were being served. And I believe that the pharmacy board eventually sent a cautionary letter to the one pharmacy that had been filling the prescriptions. And my surmise would be that Alaska being a small state, word of the subpoenas and perhaps of the letter got discussed on the pharmacist's grapevine and passed along to other pharmacists. So it would not be surprising, I guess, if naturopaths in the rest of the state found pharmacists who may have formerly been filling prescriptions written by naturopaths were less willing to do so. Certainly, any Alaska pharmacists or out-of-state pharmacists, for that matter, who called the division to ask what the rules are would have gotten a response from the division that the Alaska statute very clearly prohibits naturopaths from giving, prescribing, or recommending in the practice of prescription drug. The division felt compelled to interpret its regulations consistent with that statutory prohibition and would have received that response from the division. I do need to say that I think Director Haberger, although he's only been in his position for a little while, is quite correct that since shortly after the time when the regulations were enacted, the division has consistently taken the position that the regulations did not forge any kind of exception to the statutory prohibition. I think that it is also fair to say that the naturopaths who are testifying, who are saying, we've assumed that the regulations trumped the statute and that we were authorized to do this, are also being very truthful in their testimony. The reason why the regulations cannot trump the statute is a very lawyerly reason, which I think that reasoning is correct, but it is not reasoning that is apparent, I guess. In my discussions with naturopaths, I have not found it easy to explain the reason why the regulations cannot trump the statute. So I think it is the case that from the naturopath's point of view, it would they've assumed all along that the regulations trump the statute. The division has assumed all along that the statute trumps the regulations. And if this bill passes, I think it basically moots that legal debate, and hopefully the naturopaths and their patients can spend less money on lawyers and more money on medical treatment. I can, if the committee likes, try to summarize the reasons why the Attorney General's office and the division continue to stand by what's been called the Reardon interpretation, but the focus here is on the existing situation only insofar as that's relevant to whether the statute should be changed. If the statute is changed, I think that solves, you know, eliminates those legal issues for as far as future administration is concerned. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington. It helps. Senator Pascman.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington. Hello, Andy. To the extent that there's been confusion, it appears to me that the risk is almost non-existent to allow a practice that's been in place for 18 years to continue while we address whatever we might call to be a legal issue. Why isn't that appropriate?
Well, I would say I think it is appropriate, and I do think that in my discussion with Mr. Hayberger, you know, that the problem, I think, arises from a mismatch between the language of the statute with its fairly clear, flat prohibition and the language of the regulations, which, as many naturopaths and many attorneys have pointed out, leaves a rather large, much room for debate, I guess. I think that what the law has told the division, and I think the division is probably in accordance with this, is that if the statute is not changed to correspond to the regulatory language, it is incumbent on the division to go through the notice and comment procedure to propose a regulatory change that would be more in accordance with the flat prohibition in the statute. When I refer to that, I'm referring to LASCA 08.45.050(1A). But I do think the division has decided wisely to await the outcome of this legislative process and to not put any time or resources into proposing amendments to the regulations until we know whether this bill is going to be enacted into law or not. I think I speak for the division in saying that the division is neutral as to the merits of the bill, but recognizes that the current situation is pretty untenable. Naturopaths and their patients and the people in the division who are trying to administer this law are all disserved by the confusion created for the naturopaths, for the pharmacists, for the patients, and for the administrators by the mismatch between the regulatory language and the statutory language. The division can't change the statute. The legislature obviously can. If the statute doesn't change, I think that the division will be proposing a change to the regulation to bring it more into conformity with what we see as the original legislative intent underlying the 1986 prohibition. I'm sorry, I'm a lawyer. My answers are all very long, but that's...
You're correct. one more, and we are going to have to hold this bill. We're running out of time. We have two more bills. We have to take public testimony on Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be brief. Mr. Harrington, in AS 0845-200, this is definitions of naturopathy. It says naturopathy means the use of hydrotherapy dietetics. And then go to the end of that definition. In this paragraph, dietetics includes herbal and homeopathic remedies. Homeopathic remedies and herbal remedies are not defined there. They're defined in regulation, as you know. And it is exactly as we've been offering in this bill. So I just offer that for your consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Senator Giesel, and thank you, Mr. Harrington, for providing good information to the committee. And Mr. Habiger, it is
Mr. Chairman, before you put this bill aside, is there somebody from the pharmacies that's online?
No.
I thought they said somebody was.
No.
Oh, they said not.
Right.
So somebody testified that some pharmacists had been given out the medicine, but they had received information from the pharmacists saying that it was illegal to do so? Did somebody testify to that?
Dr. Herbert did.
So, you know, it seems like we're not going to get to the bottom of that. And right. So this bill, for 4 years I've been trying to increase the scope of practice for these doctors. And for 4 years we haven't got anywhere. So when finally they come in and say, all we want to do is just to get this part in the statute, that will take care of it, and we're willing to settle for that, and then we'll go back and fight the other part later, which they can do. I think regardless of what is being said, this needs to take place. Because the statute do trump the regulations. And if we put it in there, they're going to have to go by that. And I don't know, you know, why we, I know you want to get all the testimony and stuff that you can, but I'm really ready for this bill to be moved on, because I do believe this is the key to selling the issue that's out there.
We thank you, Senator Davis.
Not giving them any more authority than what they already have, but it's not in statute. This would put it there.
Okay, thank you, Senator Davis. Again, it's my intention for the committee to take action on this next Thursday, the Thursday meeting, to be first item on the agenda, and to move it out of Labor and Commerce one way or another. And we will take final action on this. But there is objection to the amendment. Can you withdraw your objection? Maybe we can do the amendment.
I do remove my objection to the amendment. And we now have M.4, I believe, is the amendment that I just withdrew my objection to.
Is there objection to the amendment? Senator Menard.
Yes, I just wanted to add, and Senator Giesel is going to add a few words, but after listening to the experts, you withdrew that. So I just want that on the record that we don't have a second amendment attached.
And it again, is the intent of the committee to take action on this bill final next Thursday. Again, we will not be having Labor and Commerce next Tuesday because of joint meetings that we're having in the Senate. Mm-hmm. Senator Meyer, thanks for sticking around. And we have Senate Bill 125, Motor Vehicle Transactions. It has been through committee and no further referral after Labor and Commerce. Senator Meyer and Mr. Pawlowski, it's yours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, thank you for having us here before Labor and Commerce. I believe you heard this bill in transportation already, and I want to thank this committee for hearing it. This is a consumer protection bill to protect and assist the consumer in finding competitive priced motor vehicles that are offered at competitive pricing clearly stated by the dealers. Senate Bill 125 updates our statute that is commonly referred to as the Auto Dealers Practice Act, and it does that by clarifying several provisions concerning the advertising of new and used automobiles. These revisions will assist the consumers in understanding auto comparison pricing and will eliminate any ambiguities contained in our current statutes while assisting the dealers in their quest to follow state law. This bill was drafted in conjunction with the Department of Law, Mr. Sniffen. I believe he's online. And again, it is drafted to protect consumers in purchasing a motor vehicle and in fairness to the dealers in pricing the vehicles. Additionally, this bill will take care of the contentious issue of the document fees, making this issue a moot issue. And Mr. Chairman, I can have my trusty staff, chief of staff, Mr. Pawlowski, briefly go through the section analysis if you desire.
Great. Thank you, Senator Meyer. Do any members of the committee require a sectional analysis? Great. Thank you, Senator Meyer. And we do have Mr. Sniffen online from the Anchorage LIO. Ed, go ahead and provide your testimony from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law in Anchorage. And my responsibilities, among other things, include regulating Alaska's auto dealers. And as Senator Meyer said, we have worked with the auto dealers in coming up with the language that's in Senate Bill 125 and its companion bill in the House. We think it does address some issues of confusion. It's intended to be a consumer-friendly bill that clarifies many provisions of the statute to make it easier for auto dealers and consumers as well in their buying experience. There are a couple of substantive changes. One would allow auto dealers the ability to engage in price comparison advertising with used automobiles. That's something that currently is not in statute. And then there's a change to allow auto dealers the ability to advertise free merchandise with a vehicle, which is currently something that is prohibited. I believe almost all of the other changes to the statute are clarification changes and are consumer-friendly. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Sniffen, for sticking around. Questions for Mr. Sniffen? Seeing none, don't go away yet, though, Ed. But we do have two folks in the committee room to provide testimony. Martin Martinson with the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Martinson, if you can come forward, state your name and affiliation for the record, please. And welcome.
Thank you. Martin Martinson, I represent the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chairman and Senators, I would hope that by going over this, you see that we're not trying to get an unfair business advantage. As Mr. Sniffen stated, we're simply trying to clean up some language so that there is no gray area. It's black and white. That's easier for him to enforce the law, and it's easier for us to follow the law. And, I mean, that's really the gist of it. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Martinson, for taking the time to testify, and welcome to Juneau.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Martinson? Great. Thanks. Next, John Cook, Alaska Auto Dealers Association. You're just available for questions, all right? Would anybody like to ask Mr. Cook a question? I guess not. Well, that completes public testimony on Senator 125. Senator Meyer, it's the intent of the committee to move this out, hopefully, next week. Do you have any final comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, we're, if there's any questions at all, we got all the experts here today, so, but that's the gist of the bill. It's pretty simple, pretty self-explanatory, and it's one that's, I think, has got a good balance between the Department of Law, the consumers, and the auto dealers. Everybody seems to be in concurrence with the need for this and with the bill itself.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator Meyer, and for sticking around and providing testimony and presenting your bill. And we will hold this and take action soon, Senator Meyer. And the final bill on the agenda today, Senate Bill 149, Tax Credit for Donations to Dog Mushing. Sponsor, Senator Thomas. I'm sorry, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 125. And we'll welcome Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Joe Thomas, District D, Fairbanks, Alaska. I appreciate your taking the time to hear Senate Bill 149, which is an act providing a tax credit for certain contributions to qualified dog mushing races. Dog mushing is Alaska's state sport, as you already know, and has a long and storied history and background. From its development by indigenous Alaskans to dog teams connecting and supplying mining and military camps to the Nome Serum Run to today's recreation and sports traditions. When I was a young kid in Fairbanks, actually, I lived across the street from where the races were run, the dog track was, and I used to run the dogs with one of the guys that had a kennel down the road, Jim Lundgren with Pacific Construction Company had one, so I knew many of the racers. And we used to just take them out and give them practice runs, five dog teams, things like that. But today, dog mushing not only preserves our heritage, but also brings international attention to our state. Alaska's dog mushing races inject needed money and activity into dozens of small rural Alaskan towns. Most of you are familiar with the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest, which incidentally is being run as we speak this week and part of next week. There are, however, dozens of races of all different lengths and difficulties each year in Alaska, from the Iditarod with its nearly $4 million budget to small-town sprint races run on a shoestring budget. All play a vital role in numerous towns and their economies. Senate Bill 149, the Support Alaska's Mushing Sport Heritage Act, or SAMHSA as we refer to it in my office, probably no one else will, creates a stronger financial base of support for dog mushing by bringing together the private business sector and races organized as a nonprofit through modest tax credits. SB 149 allots a certain amount of tax credits to a qualified dog mushing race who then solicit donations from the private sector on a first-come, first-served basis. By limiting the available credits, SB 149 not only limits the fiscal impacts to the state, it also creates a competitive environment for access to credits bringing in financial support earlier in the year, filling a hole that these races generally suffer on an annual basis. It's difficult to raise money for them. We're trying to make sure that they not only are successful in raising money, but can sustain that. And we look at the smaller amounts, that the way it's divvied out in tax credits, so that we do not end up with one large donor, as some sports activities in the state of Alaska have had, and then that person draws out and all the money dissipates. By incenting the small and medium-sized donations, the bill will help create a more diversified base of support that is not relying on one or more large donations. We also help foster Alaska's winter tourism industry in many of the towns and cities that they take place in. I'm sure the North American is a big deal in Anchorage, and the Iditarod obviously started as a big deal there, and then the restart of it, the official start in the Matsu, is a great opportunity for tourism activity. I urge you to join me in supporting Alaska's official state sport and Senate Bill 149. My staff member, Greer Hopkins, has a few more brief comments, and we are available for any questions. Additionally, I'd like to recognize those on the phone to speak in support, and especially George Atla, our state's first inductee into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. It has been an honor to support this upcoming state races, and we look forward to your support.
Great. Thank you, Senator Thomas. Questions for Senator Thomas? Seeing none. Have at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greer Hopkins. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Joe Thomas. The impetus behind this bill, as Senator Thomas said, was to begin developing a stronger base for our dog mushing races across the state, from the big ones to the small ones. As you can see, the last, I believe, two pages of your bill packet has two Newsminer articles from the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer highlighting this exact problem, where they have a number of operating costs that they have to cover throughout the year, but these fundraising efforts that they are able to build up on their own do not really come to fruition until the energy behind these races starts building. So they have these purses that they have, sometimes multi-hundred-thousand-dollar purses that they have to develop and cover the race expenses, cover the salaries for the people that work on the races, and so they have a budget shortfall coming up at the end, and then they have a huge hurry that they have to fill that hole. So the impetus behind, or the idea behind Senate Bill 149, would be to create a competitive system of these tax credits, where businesses that would be donating to these organizations know that there's a specific limited amount of tax credits available to them. The amount based on the budget of that nonprofit. And so these businesses would have to come to the races themselves early on in the year, or they would be running out of the allotted tax credits that are available. As Senator Thomas said, there is a specific amount of credits available to all of the races in the state, and I think it's the synopsis of how the bill would work shows that it is, like I said, based on 5% of the race's allotted budget from the year before. So with a race such as the Iditarod that has about a $4 million budget, far and above most of the other races in the state, that race would receive $50,000 in available tax credits. So worst case scenario, according to the tax division, there are 22 different nonprofit dog mushing races in the state. Most of those do not get anywhere near the $1 million $1 million budget needed to get that $50,000, but say they all start doing really well, and the worst case scenario would be $1.1 million impact to the state in these tax credits. It's not going to happen that way. That's a worst case scenario. Most of them are much, much smaller, like I said, but that would be a worst case scenario for the state. So the bill works by having these dog mushing races that are qualified nonprofits that have run a race in the previous 2 years with a minimum of a $5,000 purse. We chose that amount because we didn't want to have the Senate Labor and Commerce dog mushing nonprofit of Fairbanks running its own race for and trying to get from. Chairman, I'm glad to hear. We didn't want them to be ramshackle organizations trying to get access to the state money. So we wanted to make sure it was a legitimate organization. No offense to your committee chair, Mr. Chairman. but we wanted to make sure that it was a legitimate organization. And so within the last 2 years, they needed to run a race with at least a minimum of a $5,000 purse. At that time, the race would then submit its budget to the department and showing how much it earned or spent last year would then they would then receive a tax credit allocation from the department in that amount based on approximately 5% of their annual budget. You can see a dog mushing nonprofit with a $500,000 or less budget would receive $12,500 in credit, $500,000 to $1 million would receive $25,000 in credit, and more than $1 million would receive $50,000 in credit. Those nonprofit races would then go out and solicit their own donations from the community starting at the beginning of the year, trying to fill that hole that I was discussing earlier, and trying to really incentivize these races to make the connections with these small local businesses in their community, trying to spread about their funding base so that something like the BP Top of the World race doesn't happen where one big donor pulls out and they go defunct. So we created a step system where donations of $2,000 to $5,000 would receive 50% credit back. $5,000 to $10,000 would receive a 33% donated amount above $2,500, which is the limit for the one step below it. $10,000 to $25,000 would receive a 25% donation, and anything greater than $25,000 would be capped at $7,900 worth of tax credits for that donation. You can see there are races from all over the state. So the economic benefit would be spread all around the state. Many of these organizations, such as the Kobuk 440, the Kuskokwim 300, if you look at their donor bases, have a number of local small businesses, and we're trying to build that connection with them to help build the winter tourism and build their own base within their community and around the state. Mr. Chairman, there's, as I said, 22 different nonprofit races around the state. Since I turned in the bill packet to the committee, I've received letters of support from the City of Hooslea, the City of Allakaket, and the Montana Creek Dog Mushers Association, which runs the Sheep Mountain race out in your district. The fiscal note that you have in your packet, I will be working with the department coming up in the next week or so, trying to find a way to remove that fiscal impact to the state. It might require a small change to the structure of the tax credits, but the general impetus behind it will be the same of trying to create that diversified base. And there are people from all across the state supporting this bill. A number of them are online, so I don't want to take up too much more time. They're online to talk about how many different volunteer jobs they have in their on the race, the fundraising problems that they have, and the economic benefit to the committee, to the cities around the state.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Questions for Mr. Hopkins?
Quick question.
Senator Pascavan.
I thought I understood it, but as I understand, the maximum contribution the maximum credit that any one corporation may claim is $7,900. Is that the first step? Is that accurate?
Senator Pascavan, through the chair, yes, sir.
Okay, and then there's another layer that says if you have, depending upon the annual budget, there are caps that apply to the race so that a latecomer corporately, assuming a race were to reach that limit, wouldn't be eligible for a credit.
Senator Pascavan, through the chair, yes, sir.
Okay. And then where I'm really confused is how do you get to $1.1 million? You know, you said that's the loss to the state, or not loss, but the revenue transfer that the state will not get because of the credits is $1.1 million. That's where I'm lost.
22 races having the maximum percentage of Senator Thomas. That's the 22 races or 23, whatever the number is, 22, I believe, that exist at this point in time having the maximum amount of credit supply.
Times the 50,000.
Times the 50,000.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Because I know that there's not many races with the budget above $1 million.
No, there aren't, and that's right. Yeah, we know it's going to be much less than that, but we thought it was at least reasonable and fair to tell you what the potential impact could be. Mm-hmm. But most of these races have been in place for many, many years and have not grown dramatically. But the few bigger ones have, of course. So
I just got lost in that $1.1 million.
Senator Menard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of course, we have our beloved Iditarod and the 400 Kuskokwim, and none of us want to see it go on the red. But I often thought when we have these checkpoints all over as another point to try to get them so they're not in the red, if big sponsors would be like, say, well, we'll take Pax and Lodge. Maybe that was a sponsor point for Apache. And then another checkpoint, that would be Burger King. And, you know, I want to explore a lot of different fundraising entities before we and I think it's a great bill, and I very much support it, before we throw into a lot of these tax credits, because I think there's things, someone who I've for two decades been very involved in nonprofits, that, you know, for a little bit of effort, it's used often for golfing, for golf tournaments. Well, this hole is sponsored by, and so I just want to put that out there as long as we're on the topic.
Great. Thank you, Senator Menard. Hopkins.
Thank you, sir. Senator Menard, there are a number of creative solutions to making their ends meet. Kathy Fitzgerald, who's online with the Alaska Dog Muscular Association, could specifically talk about some of those ideas. For example, when I was doing research in this bill, the Kobuk 440 run out of the North Slope Borough uses a sponsor a mile. So each individual sponsor can choose, at, I believe it was $4,000, I believe, per mile. They would be able to say, I want to sponsor a mile, you know, 229 to 230, and be able to come up with creative solutions that way. So they've been working on that, and this is just another tool to help them fundraise.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Menard. Questions for the sponsor or Mr. Hopkins? Great. Thank you, Senator Thomas. And we do have three people signed up to testify. Joanna Bales from Department of Revenue is also online to answer questions, and I just want to let you folks know that we have less than 20 minutes left. Our meeting adjourns at 3. So, and it's an honor, Mr. Atla, are you online? Mr. Atla, are you still online?
Yes.
George, right, thank you for sticking around. And Ashley, Mr. Atla, it was my pleasure. I was on the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame Selection Committee, and it was my pleasure to be one of the first to nominate you for number one. So, George, thank you very much for staying on the line, and please provide your testimony.
Thank you. Sorry about my voice. It's pretty rusty today, but
so is mine.
I give it my best shot. I want to say thank you to Senator Thomas for introducing the bill. And I've been in dog racing for over 50 years now, and we really need help financially in the sport right now, because we are losing a lot of dog mushers because they're simply not fun to race for. And we have a lot of races in Interior Alaska that actually need help right now. Thank you very much.
Mr. Atla, again, on behalf of the entire committee, we're honored to have you testify off-net today. Now we have two folks from Fairbanks. Catherine Fitzgerald, volunteer with the Alaska Dog Mushers Association. Ms. Fitzgerald, provide your testimony, please.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Kathy Fitzgerald. I've been a volunteer with the Alaska Dog Mushers Association in Fairbanks for off and on for the past over 30 years, and
I have been helping specifically with the Open North America, and I wanted to thank Senator Thomas for the introduction of this bill and suggest that this will help to create an environment where we are able to raise additional funding for our events. The Alaska Dog Mushers Association for History was incorporated in the early 1950s, and we are host to the Open North American Championship Sled Dog Race, which in 2012 will be in its 67th consecutive running. There is, most notably, there is no other sled dog race in the world that has run consecutively for 67 years anywhere. We are the host of that in Fairbanks, and we're very proud of that fact. It does become increasingly difficult to raise additional purse money when, you know, we also have Alaska being host to a variety of sled dog races that are world renowned, and we are all somewhat competing for the same piece of the pie. Each one has its own little niche in the sled dog racing world, but we in Alaska are very fortunate to have the majority of the races that are most notable worldwide that people would like to strive to participate in. Part of that is increased funding for our purses. Across the United States, in between December and March, there's approximately, and I'll speak on behalf of sprint racing, there's a limited number of mid-distance and long-distance races, but sprint races particularly, there's over 100 of them that take place across the United States and Canada between December and March every year, with a participation level of between 3,000 and 3,500 people. We would like to attract most of those people to Alaska to come and race in our events. We have economic impact of just the Open North American alone has been estimated to be $1.8 million for the three-day event in Fairbanks, and much more statewide. There are other events that take place. I would appreciate the fact that if you could spend the amount of time that you're putting into this and put some effort into helping to create an environment of support, sorry about that, that this would really go a long way. Alaska, like I said, has been in the forefront of mushing, and it's no longer a matter of people asking if these events are going to take place. It has come to pass that people just ask when, and we have hundreds and hundreds of volunteer hours that are put into putting on these races, and having a little bit of financial support from the state, even if it's Department of Tourism dollars or however it comes through, would be a great asset to these organizations. I appreciate your support and look forward to your furthering this through to the Finance Committee.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Fitzgerald. Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Ms. Fitzgerald? Seeing none. And the last person signed up to testify, David Vandenberg. Mr. Vandenberg, representing Downtown Association of Fairbanks. Please give your name and address for the record, please, and provide your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is David Vandenberg, the Executive Director at the Downtown Association of Fairbanks, 410 Cushman Street. And while I can appreciate the statewide impact of SB 149, I come to speak in support of it through the lens of downtown economic development, and want to describe how the Yukon Quest and the Open North American, especially, by taking place in downtown Fairbanks, really promote the local businesses there. And it's a two-way street where the local businesses support and promote the races, but also their local businesses are very aware of the economic impact in an otherwise slow time of year that these major events have on their bottom lines. And I'd also like to note that all of the dog races in the interior, especially the larger ones, are promoted, I suppose you could say, cross-marketed by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau. So it's kind of a full-court press to get what we can out of these races, and the continuation and better financial support for these races means a better economic profile for downtown Fairbanks and for the interior. But what I wanted to talk a little bit about is that for the Yukon Quest, which just started last weekend, it happened to come a day after the first Friday event. and really downtown just turned out for UConn Quest. And I'd like to just read a list of businesses that were involved in supporting the send-off for the Quest. It was the Fairbanks Community Museum, the Alaska Public Lands Information Center, the Morris Thompson Cultural and Visitors Center, Big Daddy's Barbecue, the Farthest North Elks Lodge, Lavelle's Bistro, Arctic Travelers Gift Shops, Forget Me Not Books, Julia's Solstice Cafe, the Big Eye Pub and Lounge, the Fudge Pot, the Co-op Plaza, and the Pomegranate, to name most but not all of the downtown businesses that are positively impacted just last week by the UConn Quest. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Vandenberg. Questions for Mr. Vandenberg? Seeing none for the committee. And, or David, thank you very much for taking the time to testify. And with that, public testimony is closed. Okay, we have. Okay, I didn't get the list. I apologize. If you can give your name. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Andy, I apologize.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Andy Baker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'll be real brief. I know you're ready for time. I'm the chairman of the Iditarod Board, Board of Directors, and I'm very excited to be here and to testify on such an iconic traditional sport, dog mushing. It's so important to Alaska and where we've come from. And I hope through my testimony to encourage you on SB 49. There are many races, big and small, around the state, and all of them depend on fundraising, and it's very dependent, and that's what keeps them going. Most of the races are even the Iditarod at $4 million budget. You're having your banquet 3 days before your ticket drawing banquet 3 days before the race, and that has to sell all the tickets for you to pay the prize 2 weeks later. So even on the big side, you're making the budget, but it's always I hope that everything goes right to do it. So there's no cushion, and you can't plan very well for the next year. And we're at the top of the scale, and I'm from Kotzebue with the Kobuk 440 and Arctic Circle Championships and a bunch of others, and it gets even worse as smaller you go. So the fundraising is very hard to get outside sponsors, and as you know, the PETA groups chase everybody from the outside away, basically. So it's just the inside the state groups that we are able to get, and really that's good, though. We should be supportive and make it about Alaskans. But that makes the pool smaller, and as one of the speakers earlier said, they get hit over and over again. I really support the Senator Thomas's proposed bill here, the bill SB 149. I think it's really great, and I think that I'm going to ask you to expand it, and I've talked to his staff about this, but on the worst end, I really think it's great for the smaller end, and hope to see it go forward, whether my suggestions are taken or not. But because our sponsors, we've got from $5,000 sponsors to $350,000 sponsors, and so the top end are not as many, obviously. But so we'd like to see you expand the cap up to $500,000. And we don't want to rely on the one sponsor, as was talked about, but if we could get somebody to give us an extra $200,000, that would just help the longevity of being able to be a little more stable. And those, as I say, those points have been passed along. With that said, there would maybe a little more impact to the state budget. But the other side of that I'd like to point out is just the Iditarod alone for the first week of March to Anchorage in the Matsu Valley has a $10 million economic impact that a study in 2003 showed. That's not counting anywhere else along the trail, Nome, or the 20 million website hits that are gotten that bring the 350 media up to do whatever. So I think looking at it as a making each of these races all over bigger and stronger, it's going to help us also in the economics, which fuel our businesses and make things better. So most of all, this bill would stabilize and ensure the longevity of dog mushing in the state and really make it, as Mr. Atla has said, be able to keep it alive and just make it healthy. So thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Baker. And I'm sorry, I apologize that we didn't have you on the list here, but you are on the list now. And again, pass our the committee's congratulations to your brother and good luck in this year's Iditarod. Senator Pascal.
Yeah, the first Native Alaskan to win the race, so very much congratulations. It was long overdue.
Yes, thank you. And to break the record was a bonus, and this year the goal is to break it again.
Great. Thank you very much, Andy. And by the way, Don Habiger from the department is here, and also Linda Hall, Division of Insurance, is here to provide any information for members of the committee regarding this legislation. Great. Is there anyone else? That completes public testimony, and we will take action on this bill very soon, Senator Thomas. And thank you very much. And anything further to come before the committee? We're adjourned at 2:50.